From WXXI News, I'm Evan Dawson. This is Connections. What comes to mind when you hear the following names? Jack Ryan, Jack Reacher, Jack Bauer. A lot of Jacks, yes, but American heroes who are at the center of ongoing dramas. Fiction, of course, but perhaps a glint of the real world tied into it. Fictional series in print and fictional series on television. Well, you can add Judd Ryker to that genre. Judd Ryker, the new character at the heart of a novel that is out this fall called The Golden Hour. The Golden Hour has a bit of a local root to it, first of all. The author of The Golden Hour is Todd Moss, and he's a graduate of Pittsford Mendon. He went on to work in African Affairs and then was tapped by George W. Bush to work for the State Department in African Affairs in 2007. He has seen a lot, and his experiences have translated into a work of fiction that has plenty of tinges of truth to it. The book is called The Golden Hour, and it is our pleasure to welcome Todd Moss now to Connections. It has been an interesting road back to Pittsford, at least for a brief visit for Todd Moss, but as a Pittsford Mendon graduate who ended up working in African Affairs and then for the Bush administration at State for a couple of years, and now as a thriller writer, a fiction writer. Todd Moss, is it good for at least a little while to be back home in Rochester?
It's great to be home. My parents hosted a book talk at their house last night, and people came out in droves, so it was really nice. Yeah.
Did you ever imagine yourself a thriller writer?
You know, I really didn't. It was a bit of an accident. I'd been writing academic and policy books, and after my experience at State, I wanted to write about Africa and about U.S. foreign policy, and I thought it would be a lot more fun for me and more accessible to a wider audience if I did it through a fiction format.
Yeah, you know, we're going to talk about your career and the interesting turns your career has taken, but I want to start with the book because, at least to me, in reading your work, it seems to me that you're someone who maybe you've chosen to teach about Africa through fiction. Is that too broad a description, or is that fair?
Well, what I wanted to do through the book is make Africa a bit more normal to average Americans. You know, I went there as a college student, and I thought Africa was like another planet, but I was really surprised when I was there. It just seemed very normal, really energetic, lively, not at all what I expected.
Where did you go first when you were in college?
I was a study abroad student in Zimbabwe. So, an interesting case in itself, but it really hooked me for my life and for my professional career. And, you know, as Africa is becoming more important to the United States for national security and economic reasons, it seemed that fiction was a good way to tell some of that story.
And this is a time of year where we hear the word Africa in a song a lot. And the line in the song is, "There won't be snow in Africa this Christmas." The Band-Aid song from, 1984 maybe? That's going to be 30 years old. It's a Christmas time classic. We hear it every year. And in many ways, look, it's done a lot of good, but at the same time, the picture it paints for us is widespread famine, starvation, disease, and often for Americans, that's the first thing we think of when we hear Africa. Largely wrong?
Yes, largely wrong. Very, very passe view, you know, something viewed with a sort of insult and disdain in Africa.
Interesting.
You know, if we look at the list of countries that are growing the fastest, Rwanda and Ethiopia, two countries that Americans think of associated with genocide and famine, are actually among the most dynamic economies in the world, not just in Africa, but in the world. So this is really not Africa of the 1970s or 1980s.
And interesting. So you go there as a college student, you see it up close, you see how it's different than the American perceptions, but why are our perceptions still so outdated?
Well, you know, it's very far away. It's not as connected. You know, Africa is very connected to European history, with the exception of Liberia, which was founded by freed American slaves in the 19th century. The United States hasn't had a very close relationship with a lot of African countries. And that is now starting to change, thankfully. You know, when I went, there were only two programs to study abroad in Africa. And today, there are dozens and dozens of them. So we're seeing a lot more students there, a lot more travelers, a lot more investors. And it's bringing us closer together.
We're talking to Todd Moss, who is not only the chief operating officer and the senior fellow at the Center for Global Development, but his new book is called The Golden Hour. And it is perfectly timed for the holiday season. My father doesn't need anything for Christmas, Todd.
Except,
he's one of those people who all he wants when he comes home in the evening is to sit and read, and it is books like this. It's Riker books, it turns out. And we're going to get into that in a minute here, but this is it's a great time. The book's called The Golden Hour. For those of you who know the term Golden Hour, I remember when I was out of school, I was working in West Virginia, and I often covered the debates they were having about emergency response times.
Tell us
the origin of the term Golden Hour, and then we'll talk about how it applies to your book.
Well, it came exactly from emergency medicine. I when I was in college, I drove an ambulance in Boston. And one of the first things they teach you is this concept of the golden hour, that after a major trauma, a patient has to see a doctor within about 60 minutes or their chances of survival plummet. In the golden hour, I apply this. There's a college professor who finds himself in the State Department, and he finds a similar thing with international crisis. If the United States does not respond quickly to a coup or the outbreak of war, our chances of success in foreign policy plummet. And his job is to get the U.S. government to respond more quickly.
And for you, the real life connection is that you saw at State the difference between policy shapers and then reactors, right? I mean, and that might bifurcate it a little too cleanly, but essentially that's how you came to view it?
The U.S. government is so big, even within the State Department, mm-hmm. there are dozens of bureaus. And when there's a crisis, everybody gathers in a windowless conference room and has it out about what should we do? What should we even say? And because the United States is in a unique position, what the United States government says, what our ambassador on the ground says, that alone can have a very, very big impact. So I wanted to take the reader inside inside the White House Situation Room or inside one of these windowless classified rooms in an embassy and hear these arguments and debates in the middle of a crisis that reflects how policy is made.
And some of them, at least the way you represent it, they're a little distressing if you're reading, because there is a lot of infighting, and I'm sure you saw that in real life.
Yeah, I think I wanted to express a little bit of the frustration that I know a lot of people inside government feel. There are a lot of patriotic, hardworking, well-intentioned people working inside government. However, the system, because there are so many bureaus with competing interests, competing bosses, competing goals, that we often find that we're fighting more often than cooperating.
And I guess that's natural. But at the same time, what would drive anyone nuts is the closed meetings and the discussion of, well, what should we say and how will that shape public opinion and what that kind of stuff. It feels like in modern years, the public perception has become a little too close to the substance of an action.
Well, I think almost every day there's some crisis somewhere around the world. The U.S. government has looked to respond, and we've seen at the same time a proliferation of agencies and fragmentation within the agencies of interests, usually responding to good intentions, but it's just made foreign policy making that much more complicated. And that's why we often get sometimes very strange responses or sometimes very slow responses.
Well, so let's kind of take down that road then that leads eventually to this book. But let's go back to 2003 and tell me about what the Center for Global Development's mission is, and we'll start there.
So the Center for Global Development is a think tank. It's a private research institution that tries to improve the policies and decisions made in Washington, D.C., principally by the U.S. government or by the World Bank, and how those decisions affect economic opportunities in poor countries. So we work on things like global health, on private investment, on trade policy, on aid, on investment policy. And we try to make those policies work a bit better to create greater opportunities for poor countries to grow and for poor people to grow out of poverty.
It's interesting. Before you came in, I was talking to a friend about what you do and just reading over some of the work, some of the recent writings. Again, the friend I'm talking about is quite educated, mm-hmm. and still is reading even the titles of some of the papers that are coming out of the center and talking about economic development and economic drivers. And they're saying, is all of this really happening all across Africa? Again, that ignorance comes to the fore, but there's a lot happening, isn't there?
I mean, Africa is changing so quickly. Right now, if you look at the 10 fastest growing economies in the world, 3 are in Asia and 7 are in Africa. None are in Europe, none are in North America, none are in Latin America. this is Africa. Parts of Africa are becoming very, very dynamic growth engines for the global economy. This is something that that China and South Asia has recognized. They're investing a lot. The Europeans are starting to catch on, and you know, I'm grateful that American government is starting to catch on to this, but we are a bit behind the rest of the world.
Biggest industries, clean energy, others?
Well, anything in the power sector. Mm-hmm. About two-thirds of Africans live in homes without any electricity connection, so the demand is just tremendous. So the big industries are power, anything with infrastructure, roads, ports, airports, banking, telecommunications, IT, all taking off. A lot of the growth in Africa is driven by services. It's not manufacturing-led. And we're starting to see a revival of agriculture in a lot of countries as well.
And in 2007, you get tapped by George W. Bush's administration to play what role specifically, Todd?
So the State Department, there's a Bureau for African Affairs, and I was brought in to be, it's called the Deputy Assistant Secretary for West Africa. So I had 16 West African countries. And I was overseeing 15 embassies and our policy toward that region.
So Todd was not the assistant to the traveling secretary the way George Costanza was, an
right.
Inventive position with no power. This was, there was not only a great deal of important influence here, but some of the stories that you've recounted in other places. For example, that the August 2008 phone call.
That's right.
Take me through that.
Sure. I was having brunch with my family on a Sunday morning, and I got a call that there was a coup in a country in West Africa called Mauritania, which not very many people had heard of. I'd never even been there, but they were a very close counterterrorism partner for the United States in that part of the world. It was the first Arab democracy, and the United States had supported their nascent democratic institutions, and the head of the army had arrested and deposed the president, who had sat next to President Bush only a few weeks earlier. Mm-hmm. At a global democracy meeting. So this was an important moment for us, even though it's not a headline page A1 story. It was a very important moment for the United States, and Secretary Rice asked me to go to Nouakchott to meet with General Aziz and talk to him about what he was doing and how the U.S. couldn't accept the coup.
Okay, so first of all, often when we think about a coup, we think about a competing militaristic factions, et cetera. This was not the case. This was a case of a democratically elected government, right?
That's right.
And I can't imagine what it must be like to prepare for a meeting with a hostile general in a foreign country. Can you take me through that process?
Well, it was in large part a bizarre experience of political theater. He knew that that we were coming, that we were unhappy rhetorically. But the important story was that we were not going to give him a wink and a nod and say nice things about democracy, but say, well, because you're a security partner, we're gonna let this pass. So my main message in going to talk to General Aziz was, look, we legally and from a policy standpoint, we cannot continue to cooperate with your government. We had to cut off our aid program, and I think most distressing for General Aziz, we had to move our military cooperation units out of his country and into other countries in the region. He wasn't happy about that. But in the end, U.S. leverage is relatively limited in these kinds of cases, and he stayed on even though we stuck to our guns and moved our programs out of Mauritania.
What are the... And forgive me for reducing it this way, but
sure.
What are the safety considerations going into that kind of a meeting?
You mean for me personally?
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't worried about that.
Mm-hmm.
We had, there's nothing to be gained by a junta that wants to cooperate with the United States doing anything to a senior U.S. government official. Frankly, I didn't even really think about that. The ambassador on the ground was terrific. He really had his ear to the ground. He understood what those political dynamics. So I knew what I was walking into.
And the ultimate assessment of your mission? Again, leverage is limited, so it didn't pull off everything you'd hoped.
Well, the good news is that the U.S., we stuck to our principles in that case. The bad news is that General Aziz... he hung on to power, and after about a year, he held elections, which he essentially fixed and stole.
And then the region accepted those elections as good enough. He's still president of Mauritania now.
And is there any hope for true democratic election there now?
Right now, Mauritania, I don't think the conditions are very good.
Yeah.
But Mauritania is not Africa. We're talking about 54 countries. We're talking about, you know, an area that three times the size of the United States, three times the population of the United States. And a lot of countries are doing very, very well. We've seen very impressive democratic transitions in a lot of countries, particularly in West Africa. A lot of Mauritania's neighbors seem to be doing pretty well. Senegal, Cote d'Ivoire has come back, Ghana. So I think the trends in general are on a positive side. Of course, it's a rocky democracy is messy. It's messy here. It's messy in Africa. And these are still very, very young countries. The countries of West Africa have only been independent about 50 years. And so they're still getting their feet.
54 nations in Africa?
Yes.
See, I wouldn't have known that.
It's a lot.
You've been to how many of them?
I've been to about 22, 23, something like that. So not even half. That's a lot.
Remarkable. And I think maybe some of the reasons that we project smaller parts of Africa on the entire continent come from the stories of Central African Republic and issues like that. Where are the most volatile spots right now in Africa?
Well, Somalia, of course, is probably the most dangerous. It really doesn't have a government anymore. It has a very dangerous radical group called Al-Shabaab that's affiliated or associated with Al-Qaeda. Very, very dangerous situation. Central African Republic is obviously a hot spot. There are parts of northern Nigeria right now that are dealing with the Boko Haram terror group, extremely dangerous. And there are parts of the Sahara Desert where not very many people live, but in these so-called ungoverned spaces, that's what the U.S. military calls them, that's a magnet for groups that don't want they want to go in a place where there is no government so that they can either have conduct smuggling or terror operations. So that part of the world is also quite dangerous. But I would say the vast majority, I very rarely worry about my personal safety when I travel in Africa. If anything, the most dangerous thing about going to Africa is road safety. You're much more likely to get hurt in a car crash than by crime or in a conflict.
Just infrastructure issues, yeah.
Bad roads and fast cars.
I think when people, and again, I don't mean to get too off on a tangent with Todd, but it's fascinating to have someone with his background here. This summer when we heard about the kidnapped girls, you know, the average person this far away from that situation will say, how do 300 girls go missing and they can't find them? You know, that's hard for people to get their head around that, I think.
Yeah, the Chibok kidnapping was really a horrible incident. What I thought was interesting about that is the social media explosion, the hashtag bring back our girls, really generated a tremendous amount of public attention and led the White House to deploy special forces to Nigeria to help. Turns out the Nigerians did not really want our help, but we did it anyway. And this is the second time that I can think of where a Twitter hashtag campaign led to the deployment of the U.S. military. Previous one in 2012, Kony 2012, I don't know if you remember this, to try to catch a Ugandan warlord, Joseph Kony.
Mm-hmm.
There are still U.S. troops in Uganda now trying to help the Ugandans find this guy. And he'd been around. People had known about him. He'd been wreaking havoc for 15 years. But it wasn't until social media got the White House motivated that the U.S. acted so aggressively.
And I think maybe part and parcel with the view of Africa as some sort of largely famine-ridden place is also a cynicism about government. I mean, people see the story with Boko Haram and the girls, and they think this is only happening with the complicit understanding of whatever government structure is in place, and that there must be widespread corruption there and across the continent for this to be happening. Corruption a problem?
Well, corruption is certainly a problem.
Yeah, it's too broad a question.
Right. But I mean, Nigeria is a really fascinating place because it's a microcosm of everything good and everything worrying that's going on in Africa. You have terrorists, you have corruption, you have oil theft, you have international criminal cartels, drug trafficking. You have all of that stuff that makes people, nervous. But you also have an incredible economic dynamism. The country, the commercial capital of Lagos is becoming a real international capital of commerce and culture. They've got a booming international film industry. The banking industry is booming. Tech. It's really a very exciting place, and that's going on inside the same country that's also dealing with some of those problems.
My guest for the hour is Todd Moss, the Chief Operating Officer and a Senior Fellow for the Center for Global Development, and most importantly, the author of a new thriller, a work of fiction called The Golden Hour, in which he has used his experience and his travels to create a fictional landscape that feels a lot, well, at least it seems to be a lot like the real world. And so let's talk about the book. Let's talk about The Golden Hour. First of all, any of your former colleagues, especially at State, concerned that your writing would be too close to reality, even though it's fiction?
No, I think they've loved that it's close to reality.
Really?
And I think, you know, people get, people love when they have personal frustrations or professional frustrations at work and somebody else expresses them in this way, they, you know, people, I think, really latched on to that. I had a roundtable at the State Department just about 2 weeks ago with the group that started a special unit that was sort of the inspiration for the special unit that I put in The Golden Hour. And they said, oh, you know, they absolutely loved it. They really felt that somebody was sharing their experience of the infighting of trying to get things to work better inside a very sclerotic bureaucracy. And also, you know, I tried not to paint very one-dimensional evil and good characters, but lots of people fighting within a system that are all trying to do their jobs.
What do you like to read?
I mostly read nonfiction. I'm still a policy nerd. My wife still makes fun of me for reading Paul Krugman on our honeymoon. But I've been trying to read a lot more fiction. Since The Golden Hour only came out in September, I've only really been a fiction author for a couple of years. I've been reading a lot of fiction in that genre to try to understand the marketplace, try to see how other people are portraying some of these similar incidents, including how U.S. diplomats are being portrayed in faraway places, which I think is the niche I'm going for.
Yeah, and so the sexy part of the niche is CIA, spies, the Ludlamic kind of ideal, and maybe racing across European capitals or the Middle East. Is Africa going to be a barrier for you to reach readers, and are you concerned about that?
You know, I was initially worried about it when I first tried to sell my manuscript. I heard from several agents that Africa wasn't commercial, it wasn't mainstream. And what happened is the story I set was, it was based on the coup in Mauritania, but I set The Golden Hour in Mali because nobody's heard of Nouakchott, Mauritania, but everyone has heard of Timbuktu, which is a real city in northern Mali. And this agent, what had happened is a few weeks after I finished the book, there was a real coup in Mali. And this one agent who had just received my manuscript, he hadn't even read it yet, was watching BBC News about a coup in Mali, terror groups running around, and then eventually French troops having to invade the country. And he said, oh my God, I've got this manuscript about this going on. And I think that helped. So I signed with him a few days later. And that fiction becoming reality helped to sell to a top of the line publisher like Penguin, and I thought, okay, this is good. I'm breaking new ground. Africa will become more mainstream. And actually, Penguin has several thrillers now set in sub-Saharan Africa. So I'd like to think we're starting a little bit of a trend, making Africa a little bit sexy, and trying to make it a more normal part of American consciousness, where people would think, okay, we have real interest there. And I'd like to read a thriller set in that part of the world.
So let's talk about Jed Ryker, who is a professor who has interesting ideas, but often in academia, well, this is not to malign academia, it's just the reality that it's not always that those ideas get plucked into the real world. But tell us what happens with Jed Ryker.
Well, I mean, academic, people use that word to mean irrelevant.
which I am not,
right,
by the way.
So Jed Ryker, college professor at Amherst, playing with data. This is what's really going on in academia now. A lot of political scientists play with numbers to see if they can discern something about the world. He finds that reaction time, he finds the golden hour in the data. If the U.S. reacts quickly, we have high chances of success. the U.S. reacts slowly, we have a low chance of success. And he comes and he's very proud. He presents this at the State Department. The chief of staff says, wonderful, you're hired. And your job is to get us to react more quickly. But what he finds is that nobody inside the State Department wants to listen to some outside academic. They've got their turf. They've got their job to do. He has to wind his way through the bureaucracy and build allies. I had originally called the book the back channel. He has to find back channel efforts to get his job done. And his first big challenge is a coup in Mali, where a U.S. ally has been overthrown. There's been a Peace Corps volunteer who's been kidnapped, and there's a terror threat against the U.S. embassy. And he has 100 hours to reverse the coup, to rescue the hostage, and to protect the embassy. So.
And we're not going to give away everything that happens, but no. I can already say that Todd indicated that the book took you, well, a couple of years. How long?
Well, I wrote it, you know, early in the morning, a couple hours at a time. It took about 3 years
about
to do
three
the
years.
First one.
And so you go from finding publishers a little resistant to the notion of Africa as a setting to having this book out now, your first book, and you're well into the second. We're going to see that next year. How many Judd Ryker books could there or will there be?
Well, there will definitely be four. I've got a four-book contract. The second book is called Minute Zero. It's about an election in Zimbabwe that's blowing up, based loosely on the real 2008 election in Zimbabwe that went very badly. I'm working now on the third book, which will be out in 2017, which is about Cuba and South Florida. Don't want to be all Africa all the time. And the fourth book, we'll have to wait and see.
Okay, but how remarkable for you to have that contract. And many writers, even though you may read mostly nonfiction, as I do, but anybody who's read fiction, has friends in fiction, or has dealt with the industry knows, it's difficult enough to get one contract, let alone a multi-book contract. I mean, that has got to be remarkable comfort for you, even if it's pressure. You know, John Grisham wrote The Firm, and all of a sudden he had to write five books in 3 years. That's pressure, but that's the pressure you probably want.
Yeah, absolutely. The pressure is great. I mean, knowing that you've got an audience, knowing that you have a deadline is incredibly motivating.
Coming up in our second hour, are extreme weather events related to climate change? There are questions about hurricanes, large snowstorms, extreme rain events, and whether we should expect that is tied to global climate change. An atmospheric scientist from Columbia University has written a book about the subject. He is our guest next hour, answering our questions and yours. Join us.
Support for Healthy Friday is made possible in part by Excellus Blue Cross Blue Shield. Find answers to health insurance questions or explore financial aid options with a financial assistance estimator online at chooseexcellus.com/AID. And the Corning Glass Museum, featuring two exhibitions of Art Nouveau and Art Deco works by French artist and designer René Lalique, open 7 days a week in Corning, New York. Details at cmog.org.
The book's called The Golden Hour, and the events in Mali in the book, we talked about some of your own experiences, and we talked about some of what's happening. As a fiction writer now, do you want it to be as close to reality as possible?
Well, I think it was very important for me that the story and the settings were seen as authentic. You know, it would have killed me if my former State Department colleagues thought I got a lot wrong and it didn't seem they couldn't identify with it. But I also wanted to make it, you know, give it a faster pace and make it accessible to people who've never worked in government and want nothing to do with that, just want to read a fun yarn. So I try to draw on real-world experiences. I try to make it seem realistic for how U.S. foreign policy responds, the kinds of challenges and threats that we face overseas, the kinds of opportunities that are out there. But it is, at the end of the day, fiction. The characters are not real people. Some of them are inspired by real people I've known. But you want to make it fun in the end. If it's not fun, then you failed.
When it comes to that initial title, Back Channel, it made me think of some of the fiction we see on television, shows like 24. In 24, there's always a mole, which is a really nice device for the creator of fiction. And yet, seeing the way Riker has to build these sort of alliances and work through back channels, I'm not saying that Golden Hour is riddled with moles, but I'm wondering in the real world if those divisions and alliances, should they worry us that they can divide an organization that's supposed to be working cohesively?
Well, my books don't have grand conspiracies, which I think a lot of people think
right.
exist. And, you know, when you watch how the government works, trying to organize a conspiracy is incredibly difficult.
Thank goodness.
That's right. That's a good thing. But when the government is so large and it's so complicated, the only way people can get things done is to build personal relationships and personal alliances. And so Judd Riker has to do this. He has to build an alliance with a CIA analyst. He has to build an alliance outside government. There's a lobbyist who plays a very key role. You know, I think for a lot of people it might surprise them that the lobbyist is one of the heroes. She's actually one of the more powerful, insightful characters, which I found to be true. There's some incredibly good lobbyists in Washington that really have their finger on the pulse of what's going on.
I thought borderline omniscient. I mean, smart, resourceful, powerful women in this book. We'll get to that in a second, but go ahead.
So, and that's really how it works. That was certainly my experience. I had to build relationships to get done what the administration was trying to accomplish. You know, on my first day in the job, we were at the end of the administration. There was a very clear deadline, and my boss said, look, this is what we want to achieve in West Africa. This is what we want to do in Nigeria, in Liberia, in Mali, in the region. This is what I want you to achieve with our short time that we have here. And I want you to remember that the enemy to getting all of this done is right here in the building. And that was a sort of first lesson that I needed to build relationships, take people to coffee, start to horse trade so that I was not walking into meetings blind and I was able to get things done.
I don't think you're saying, because enemy is a strong word, I don't think the implication is that our government is working against us. I think enemy in terms of inefficient bureaucracy or inability to move policy and progress? Is that kind of what you mean by that?
Well, there's both. There are always people in a bureaucracy that would rather do nothing rather than do something mm-hmm. that's difficult. But there's also very often competing interests. A central tension in the Golden Hour, which exists in U.S. foreign policy every day, is, for example, a tension between democracy and security. So right after a coup, and we saw this in real life in Egypt not that long ago, the U.S. government has to take a position. There may be a security partner. We've had a coup. The military is a partner in us fighting terror groups in helping us with our own national security, but we also want to support democracy. How do we prioritize that? What's our posture? How do we work out that tension? And that's precisely the tension in the Golden Hour. There's a part of the U.S. military that wants to continue to work with the junta because there's a security threat against the embassy right now. And Riker is also under instructions to restore the democratically elected leader, and he has to work out that tension.
Talking to Todd Moss, a Pittsford Mendon graduate who went on to work for George W. Bush's State Department and works now at the Center for Global Development, African Affairs, and is back briefly talking to us about his brand new book, The Golden Hour. It's out now, and I touched on the fact there are some strong women. Judd Riker at the center of the book, but not by no means the only important character. And some authors are very conscious of gender and sending a message, et cetera. Are you? Does that matter to you? Because I mean, there are some strong women in this book.
Yeah, there are a lot of strong women. And I get this question a lot, which is funny because I didn't really plan it that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Secretary of State is a woman. That frankly seemed normal. That is, in a sense, the new norm in Washington. I certainly worked for a very strong Secretary of State. And my immediate boss, the Assistant Secretary, was also a very strong woman. I've lived in a house of strong women my entire life, and that just seemed a normal part of reality now.
So for you as an author, yeah, that's just part of the world that you live, which I think, by the way, good, I guess. I mean, you know, maybe we shouldn't be so obsessed. It's just, it's an interesting dynamic I'm not going to give too many of the characters away, but are you cognizant now as an author that you can't kill certain characters, that you can't kill Riker for a while, but you start thinking long term now that there's a contract?
Well, I'm certainly thinking through four books.
Yeah.
And what I mostly think about is, you know, as you start writing, you start to really like certain characters and you want to bring them back. I've got a couple, you know, the CIA analyst named Sunday, who's a first generation American with Nigerian parents. He's one of my favorite characters. And he will continue to grow and be a more important role in future books. So you start to like certain characters. You help them develop. Others, maybe you lose interest and they start to fall away. Maybe you kill them off. You want to keep the reader guessing. You don't want to make it too predictable.
You have to be careful. I mean, you've seen Misery, right? You read Some people get very attached to your characters, which will only be a hat tip to your work. The book's been out since September, right?
That's right.
So it's been out for just a little while now, but are you starting to find feedback? And how attuned are you as an author of the feedback that comes in?
Well, certainly I've gotten a lot of messages from former colleagues that loved it. I got a great email from somebody who ran the White House Operations Center who said he loved it. I took that as a great endorsement. And, you know, one of the early things they say is that as a young new writer, don't read all of your Amazon reviews.
But I've read your Amazon reviews, and they're largely great. And by the way, those can be vicious. That's good advice to you, but yours are really good for the most part. There's always going to be those dissatisfied people, but yours are very good.
They are good. It's, you know, I think this is not a typical thriller. It's not a hyper adrenaline, lots of blood and gore and guns story, which a lot of thrillers are. And I think a lot of people expect a lot of that. This is more of trying to be a complicated sort of political intrigue crossed with a thriller. But, you know, what's been remarkable is how many people who don't know anything about Africa or about my professional life have just really sent just such warm, encouraging messages, have loved it. I think people love to read fiction, and they also feel that when you write fiction, it's not like writing an academic book. You're really putting, you know, yourself out there in a way, and you try to be thick-skinned about it. I always feel like I'm thick-skinned about my writing. But it's been really endearing to get these great messages.
The genre that you're in has a lot of competition, but at the same time, there is a relatively small handful of super successful, easy, marketable, surefire hit, massive stars. And I wonder, with the Golden Hour out now and more books coming, have you considered, are you ready in case you end up in that atmosphere?
Absolutely.
You're ready?
Ready for success.
It's a strange question, but I mean, I'm talking near household name, book that instantly will sell a million books the second it comes out. I don't think that it's impossible that Todd Moss ends up there.
Well, I hope you're right. That would be a lot of fun. I don't want to get ahead of myself.
Does your wife keep you grounded?
She does. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's very important. Your wife and your kids make sure that you know that you're still old dad. I think, you know, taking it one step at a time, writing it for fun, trying to keep it, keep your perspective on what you're really trying to do. I love my day job at the Center for Global Development. I'm not looking to leave the policy world. I think it also gives me a lot of material for future books. But this has been really terrific ride, very, very fun. And so far, you know, if it stays fun, that would be wonderful.
Ryan, Reacher, Riker, those names all line up in sort of a hallway of heroes, don't they? And then the translation to the screen for a lot of them has been relatively easy. And I don't know what you're allowed to tell us, but already I think it's fair to ask if the Golden Hour and Riker ends up on screen somewhere.
Well, I think it would be a natural for a TV series or for a film. We have had some inquiries from California on this. We'll certainly explore all of those. My agent's pretty aggressive at this as well. Nothing yet. It's early days, but I think it would be a lot of fun to turn it into a TV show.
A friend of mine is a fiction writer, and her second book was optioned, but she said, boy, I went out to California and realized I knew nothing about California and how this industry works. You know, just because it's optioned doesn't mean it goes somewhere. And then it doesn't mean that you'll have all the control or even as much control as you want over the product. But I guess those are what we call good problems to have, right?
Exactly. I hope I've got stress over that.
What is the process for you now that you're under contract? You said you wrote in the morning for about 3 years for the Golden Hour. Have you had to increase the quantity in terms of getting the next three books done?
So I'm a hyper compartmentalizer. So what I do is I block out time during my week, usually early in the morning, three times a week. For about 90 minutes, and I work on fiction then. That's when I think about it. That's when I write about it, and the rest of the day, I have to concentrate on my day job. If I let either of them bleed into each other, it becomes chaotic.
Do you find when you're writing, do you have to almost shut down email, internet, other communications because it is so easily distracting?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Yeah. You have to really just focus. I can work in a noisy room. I can work in my kitchen while my kids are having breakfast. No problem. It drives them crazy when I don't hear them. But you absolutely have to shut down media. You have to sit in the chair, stare at the screen, and just concentrate on what you're trying to do to get it done.
Brief glimpse of book two.
So book two, there's a again fiction, but it draws on reality. In Zimbabwe, there's a longtime dictator who's in the process of stealing another election, and Riker is sent in to try to see if he can encourage a better democratic outcome in that election. But he finds that the embassy isn't interested in that, the U.S. embassy isn't interested in all that, and there are a lot of machinations behind the scenes going on that he has to figure out, working with a lobbyist and building local alliances to figure out what to do. In the first book, I wrote it, wrote about a coup in Mali, and then a real coup happened. In the second book, I'm writing about an election in Zimbabwe with an aging dictator. So I'm hoping that my powers of prescience come true again.
And we'll see the second book when?
It'll be out in the fall of 2015, and it'll be called Minute Zero.
Minute Zero. The first book is The Golden Hour. Todd Moss is the author of that. He is... I keep saying it, but we're proud to say he's a Pittsford graduate. He works at the Center for Global Development and worked in the George W. Bush State Department for a couple of years, 2007-2008. Before we let you go, since we have you here, can we just talk a little bit about some of the world events we're seeing?
I mean, sure.
Someone with your background, it's first of all, I was struck by the fact that there was, I understand the fear around Ebola that happened, and thankfully now... Ebola isn't gone, but it is not the at least domestic outbreak that a lot of people feared, et cetera. At the same time, a lot of the consternation was happening and the calls for policy and the calls for action were happening right before an election. And it just seems to have evaporated right after the election. Now, at the same time, even the cases of infected doctors, et cetera, has calmed down. And the election does seem to be a bit of a coincidental part of the timeline. But I don't know how coincidental that is. Should I be bothered that there was so much talk about policy right before an election, and now it seems to be gone?
You know, the Ebola outbreak happened, and in many ways, some of the early mistakes by the CDC and the mishandling of the case in Dallas, it reinforced a lot of people's mistrust of government. They just thought, the government is lying to us, they're incompetent, they're not protecting us, and what was happening with Ebola was sort of reinforcing that. And that, of course, pervades a lot of the election rhetoric. What I found most distressing is that the U.S. government, you know, looking from Washington, D.C., we had a lot of early signals about the problem of Ebola. It was diagnosed in as early as December last year. We pulled out our Peace Corps volunteers in July. And it wasn't until September that the White House really got its act together to deploy a big force to stop it at the source in West Africa, which is really the only way to contain a virus like Ebola.
So they failed in the Golden Hour?
They really missed it. I think the effort that they've made since has been pretty remarkable, and I've been happy to see that. But I think that it's not too much to say that hundreds, if not thousands, of people who died wouldn't have had to die if we had reacted more quickly. Now, you could say, why is that the U.S. government's responsibility? But The reality is that the U.S. government has a unique capability in the world to deploy in these kinds of situations. The U.S. military has unique capabilities. And the American public is going to demand it. If we can save thousands of innocent people by doing something at low cost, we should do it. We've done that with AIDS. We've done that with malaria. We'll do that with Ebola. And I think that's I think we should be proud of that.
There was some calls for shutdown flights from the entire continent, things like that. Was that over the top?
It was completely over the top. I understand that Ebola even sounds scary, and the idea that it was going to ravage the United States, people panicked. You know, they're keeping their kids home from school. We had a total of 4 cases in the United States, some of the panic, what really worried me is that talking about flight bans or quarantines actually made us less safe, because groups that were sending nurses and doctors to West Africa, all of a sudden when we started talking about flight bans and quarantines, their volunteers dried up. And that actually made it worse in West Africa, which then raised the threat to us. Sometimes good politics makes really awful policy. And I think Ebola is a good example of that.
The State Department is not the CIA. And so you've got some distance from what we've seen in the last 24 hours to talk about the report, people talking about torture. But I know, you know, your colleagues have been in different levels of government, and I try to take a step back and consider the entire picture. A lot of people are disturbed by some of what they've read. Are you, you've been on the inside at State. How do you view what we've been talking about in the last 24 hours with this report?
Well, I think what I find most problematic for the long term, obviously there are some internal control issues on the intelligence side that will have to be dealt with. I worry that there are big long-term implications for our intelligence services, given the nature of the threats that we face, which are about underground networks of criminals or terrorists, that those are our principal threats. We are increasingly reliant on the intelligence services to protect us, and anything that undermines them like this, it undermines their credibility, it will certainly lead to a shakeup, will make us less safe over the long term, and I worry about that effect. I also think that it makes us look like hypocrites on the international arena. It's very difficult for the Secretary of State to talk about democracy and human rights when we've got our own people behaving in ways that are not consistent with American values. And I do believe, and this is, you know, getting back to the golden hour, that we often have some short-term priorities that make us do things we wouldn't like to do, but that our long-term security is best served when we stick to our values, when we stick to American principles, and we stand up for what we believe is right. It doesn't mean we're going to do this all the time, as we've seen in the last couple of days.
Sure.
But that is in our long-term interest for all Americans.
And last point on that, what do you make of people who say it's even anti-American to look too critically at this, that this is an exceptional country, that we have a bigger role in the world, and it's anti-American to criticize our behavior when these people are just trying to protect American interests?
Well, I think it's very American to criticize ourselves. That is what we should do. We're an open society. I think we all want to live in an open society that that lives up to our principles, and we should continue to do that. I think the worrying thing for me, and thankfully I wasn't involved in any of these issues in any direct way, is that a lot of people at the lower levels were doing things within guidelines that they were told, this is how to operate, this is what the legal line is. And then when those lines get changed later, they're the ones that pay the price. So I think clarity, this is going to make recruitment into the Central Intelligence Agency much, much more difficult. And I think that a lot of people are going to worry about the long-term implications of that.
Todd Moss, the author of The Golden Hour, and really just remarkable career turn for a guy who has worked, came from Pittsford, Mendon, ends up working on African affairs, ends up working for the State Department, traveled to dozens of countries around the world, and now a fiction writer. You can get the book now, The Golden Hour, and if he never imagined that this would be the case, The book is already taking off. Congratulations. Thank you for taking the time. It's great to see you here.
Great. Thanks, Evan. It's great to be back in Rochester.
I want to also thank the World Affairs Council of Rochester for helping facilitate this interview. Todd Moss was a guest this week of the World Affairs Council of Rochester. And if you don't know them, they do some wonderful things in an effort to bring in-depth, timely information on world events to members of the World Affairs Council of Rochester right here. And so you can check out their website. They're online, worldaffairsroc.org. That's worldaffairsroc.org. So our thanks to them, and they have they've provided a number of other guests, I should also say. So thanks very much to them. Thanks to Todd Moss as well for taking the time. And thank you for listening this hour. I'm Evan Dawson. Much more ahead on Connections right here on member-supported public radio. We're looking at climate change when it comes to severe weather. Is there a connection? An author joins us next to tackle that very question.